and welcome to a Monday episode of Catholic Answers Live. I am not your regular host, Cy Kellett, because Cy Kellett is trapped on an airplane, just like in that movie, Airplane, or possibly Die Hard 2, or hopefully not like Die Hard 2, but he's on a plane that has been rerouted and unfortunately was not able to make it into the office today. So instead of Cy Kellett as the host of Catholic Answers Live for this Monday, it is the guest, now turned host, turned half guest. I'm Trent Horn, staff apologist and speaker here at Catholic Answers. And for the second hour of the show, our guests are Dr. Greg Popcheck and his son. They will be speaking with us. We have Dr. Greg Popcheck and Jacob Popcheck. They're going to talk to us about Lent and, in particular, fasting from falsehoods. Two experts in counseling and psychology in the second hour of the show today. They're going to be talking to us about how to fast from those destructive things that we do in our own little minds, things that we say to ourselves, think to ourselves, that can lead us to being kind of miserable. So if you'd like some help, a little session here with the Catholic counselors, Dr. Greg and Jacob Popcheck, be sure to tune in for our second hour. It's going to be a real treat. But for the first hour, it's even more of a treat here. You have myself as host and half guest talking about a new book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? The answer is no. Here's why. My newest book, co-authored with Catherine Pakulik. So Catherine is an assistant professor at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. She specializes in the economics of education and religion, family studies, and demography, Catholic social thought, and political economy. She earned her doctorate at Harvard University in 2010, and she's authored in highly cited articles in Economic Inquiry, Journal of Markets and Morality, Demography, and the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. She also lives in Maryland with her husband, philosopher Michael Pakulik, and her eight children. She is my co-author, so you get the both authors of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? I, Trent Horn, and Catherine Pakulik, who is joining us. Catherine, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thanks, Trent. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm super excited, and if you have questions about the topic we're talking about today on the show is, can a Catholic be a socialist? So you probably heard a lot about socialism in the news nowadays. I mean, we have the election is going on right now. We have Super Tuesday tomorrow. So people are talking a lot about socialism. It's been the zeitgeist recently for the past few years. And this was something, so if you have a question about can a Catholic be a socialist, socialism or capitalism, how the Catholic faith intersects with economics, you've got a Catholic apologist, you've got a Catholic economist here on the hour today to answer your questions. The number is 888-318-7884. Once again, you have questions about can a Catholic be a socialist, or if you want to talk, we could even get into capitalism or economic issues. Just talk about, call us at 888-318-7884. And for those who are wondering, I was given some advice from people about 18 months ago. Some friends said to me, friends of the apostolate, you should write a book on socialism. It's happening a lot right now. I said, yeah, but I'm interested in the subject, but I'm not an expert per se in that area. And they said, well, you should get an economist to help you. And I wonder, well, who could I go to? And I was referred to Catherine Pakulik, to you, Catherine. And it was wonderful because you had already written a peer-reviewed article for a journal on Pope Leo, the Leonine popes, like Pope Leo the 13th and Pope Pius XI, and their views on socialism. So what motivated you to write on that subject in a journal article shortly before I wanted to write on this book?
Yeah, so that was clearly providential, right? So let me think. So I guess this goes back on my side all the way to the beginning of teaching the material at a Catholic college. So it might be a shock to you or your readers, or your listeners, our audience today, that in graduate school in economics these days, people don't study socialism straight. So actually, after I finished graduate school and I started teaching in a small Catholic college, I started teaching courses on the history of the Pope's thought on economic and social issues. And so, you know, I, like a student, I just dove in and started reading the text straight up. And after almost 6 years of teaching that material to students, I had a fair number of notes that I had used, you know, and it was just my attempt to understand what I was reading on the page, you know. And to be honest, when I went back and started reading these things that, you know, were kind of for the first time, from my perspective, I thought, this is outrageous. I mean, I never knew that the Pope said all these things about socialism. So I was surprised. I shared that with my students. I had a lot of notes. And then about now going back about 3 years, Jerry Bradley, who's a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame, approached me and said, look, we're going to put together a new set of essays on the history of Catholic social thought. Do you think you want to handle sort of the treatment of socialism and capitalism? And I said, well, funny you should ask. I have all these notes.
Right.
So that's kind of how it came about.
What were some things that really surprised you in the papal statements on socialism? A lot of people don't know that, I mean, socialism, its genesis, and you and I covered this in the book, it begins really in the early part of the 19th century with scientific utopianism, scientific socialism. Then the middle part of the 19th century, we get Marxist socialism. But from that point on, the popes are unanimous, condemnatory, and they do not mince words what they use.
Yeah. So sometimes with my students, I call this papal language, right? So we do have this idea that up until, you know, maybe about 100 years ago, the popes, you know, they denounced things. Things were anathema. We understand that the popes don't use this kind of language as much anymore. But if you do dig back, you know, you find out actually these things like denouncements and things that are anathema, they were applied readily to socialism and all varieties of socialist thought at the time. So things like, you know, perverse, wretched misery, you know, absolutely pernicious, a fiction, people dreaming about things that they would like to have, but disconnected from reality. I mean, pretty harsh stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the context that really drove this the most. And then when we come back from the break, we'll go to our callers that we already have on the line starting to fill up. And if you have a question about socialism, capitalism, the Catholic view of economics, you can give us a call. You got an apologist and an economist right here to answer your questions. That is 888-318-7884. The topic is, can a Catholic be a socialist? The most famous encyclical that we cover in the book is Rerum Novarum by Pope Leo XIII. In fact, we devote several chapters, actually, to that issue. And your peer-reviewed article you previously wrote on the subject was incredibly helpful to see that. And I think a lot of people think, well, socialism is wrong because it's authoritarian. You think about gulags. And if you just had a more sanitized version, it would be okay. But that wasn't the main thing, the main concern that Pope Leo XIII had when it came to socialism, though. And so what was his main concern, and what was like kind of the milieu happening at that time to motivate him to address the issue?
Yeah, so the Pope was worried about it. I mean, probably for some of the same reasons we're worried about it today, in the sense that, you know, there's this kind of growing sense of a growing divide between the rich and the poor. At that time, the poor were, you know, more often described as kind of the working class. And those at that time, we had not experienced the economic growth we've had in the last 100 years. So the working class that the Pope was concerned about was kind of like the vast majority. It was like 80 to 85% of people that he was looking at. Mm-hmm. And the concern was, well, and actually, just to quote from the Pope himself, he said, you know, because life is difficult for the working class and there are very, very difficult economic circumstances, the socialists want to work on the poor man's envy of the rich. And his concern was that socialism would seem very appealing, but his biggest concern was it will end up being worse for the poor. So that this is why it's perverse. It actually hurts the people that it's most meant to help. Mm-hmm. So that's the first point, right? Is that he just kind of jumps in there and says, hey, wait a second. You know, this isn't a Catholic move to make.
Right. There's a problem. There are people who are poor.
There's a problem.
And he talks about, and I love in Rerum Novarum, he talks about how employers have the responsibility to essentially not grind their employees into dust, which is what happened in coal mines and in factories that were very dangerous to work in. But while recognizing these legitimate concerns that people had to see, but the solution, the seductive poison of socialism, as it's called, which Pope Leo XIII says will reap. He says it reaps a harvest of misery, to say that that's not the answer. So we will come back to discuss that, and especially to get into what is socialism and comparing it to things that socialism is not. So we have Alan and Bobby on the line. We'll be getting to your calls very soon here. But until then, be sure to go to shop.catholic.com. to be able to check out our book. You can get a copy of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist there at shop.catholic.com, available in print ebook versions now, and will eventually be available in audiobook read by myself. So I've read through the whole book, and if you like listening to books, you will be able to have that as well. So I think, and you know, and this is always a good test whenever I'm the host, because I never get it quite right. But we will be back to talk about socialism. Alan and Bobby, stay on the line. We'll be back right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy. A brand new episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, is now available. Check it out at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This week, we talk with Jimmy Akin about the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Essene community. What do the documents of this ancient group tell us about Jesus and his times? Check out this week's conversation with Jimmy and get access to past episodes at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
St. Augustine gives us tremendous insight as to why we should pray. He says this: why God should ask us to pray when he knows what we need even before we ask him may perplex us if we do not realize that our Lord and God does not want to know what we want, for as God, he cannot fail to already know it. But rather, he wants us to exercise our desire through our prayers so that we may be able to receive what he is preparing to give us.
Welcome back to another Monday episode of Catholic Answers Live. I am your host, Trent Horn, filling in for Cy Kella today. Cy is trapped on an airplane somewhere. He was supposed to be here, but his plane was rerouted. Pray for him that he finds his way home, that he doesn't get land somewhere and then have to take a bus to get here, or who knows what'll happen, but I will do my best to fill in for him. Today's show, in the second hour, we have Dr. Gregory Popcheck and Jacob Popcheck on to talk about fasting from falsehoods, wonderful counselors on how to live healthy spiritual and emotional lives during Lent. But here from the first hour, our guest is Catherine Pakalik, my co-author on the newest book from Catholic Answers Press, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? The answer is no. Here's why. And so we were talking about some of the preliminaries related to socialism, and we got a few callers who have questions about socialism, capitalism, Catholic economics. Would you like to go to callers?
Absolutely.
All right, great. First up, we have Alan from Cincinnati, Ohio. Alan, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you. I have a pretty underinformed perspective on all this. Can you hear me?
We can.
I hear you great.
Okay. But I would, my two questions are, how much is Bernie Sanders a socialist? Is he like your classic socialist? And then the other one is, I have childhood friends who've like posted that if you believe in social security, then you're a socialist. So I'm like, I don't know enough to know how to refute that appropriately. Or, I mean, you know, it doesn't seem bad to have Social Security.
Sure.
So I guess I'm a little confused on it all.
Well, how about this? I'll take question one. I think Catherine can handle question two, and we'll run through that. First, as a policy we have in our book, our book does not talk about current political candidates. We do mention former politicians and politicians overseas, but our book is not anything that's siding with particular for or against particular candidates in the current U.S. election. So we don't offer any commentary on current presidential candidates. I would recommend that you go to their platforms at their respective websites to see what they believe. I'd recommend, and guess what? I get to do this because I'm the host and I'm just going to do it. Everybody who calls in, who gets through the line, maybe we'll get some more callers here. Can I do that? Everyone who calls in? Yes, I'm getting everyone who calls in. And we will give you a free book. And guess what? That's not socialism we're doing, because we're a private entity with our own collection, free to give away as we will.
That is power, Trent.
Yeah, it is. Use responsibly. So Alan, you and the other callers today will get a copy of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? So I would recommend that if you have a question about a presidential candidate, go to their website, read their platform to see what policy proposals they are suggesting. and then compare that to the chapters we have in our book on what is socialism, what we cover democratic socialism, which is a very malleable term that can mean many things to different people. Mm-hmm. And what we say is that, and I think Catherine can speak to this as well, socialism is not something that's black or white. It comes in degrees in understanding what it is. And as something becomes more socialist in its policy in favor of central planning, of nationalizing industries, we should become more and more skeptical of it until it reaches full-blown socialism. So that's our stance when it comes to political candidates. Your second question was, are you a socialist if you support policies like Social Security, where government provides entitlements or benefits to everyone through taxes or things like that? Catherine, is someone who supports things like Social Security, is that socialism?
Yeah, so no, absolutely not, Alan. It's a really great question. So that Social Security falls under the heading of things we would think of as social welfare programs. And there's a whole variety of them, right? We could have more or less generous Social Security or Medicaid or public education systems, public health care systems. Those are not formal socialism by any means. Now, they could be implemented by different politicians or at different points in time as a kind of path to socialism, right? Because in the classical sense, maybe mentioned classical socialism. In the classical sense, we think of the state or the nation taking on greater and greater numbers of functions for the citizens in their economy. So those things could be, these social welfare programs could be put in place as a kind of explicit or implicit path to socialism. But in the ordinary sense that we think of them, like as an American who pays into Social Security, no, it definitely doesn't make you a socialist. Though they're certainly open to questions of prudence that, you know, Catholics and Christians could debate about, you know, whether they've been working or what they were put in place for, whether they're going to be able to survive into the next couple of generations with falling fertility rates. And those are all interesting questions. But absolutely, just to address your question, no, definitely doesn't make you a socialist.
Yeah. And Alan, what I would say is the point we raise in our book that you can say to your friends to say, well, if you're for Social Security, you're for socialism, to say, well, by that logic, if there are some things government provides to everyone or to a particular group of people, so like Social Security is something you can collect. Usually, I think it's at age 65 or 66 or 70, depending on how much of a payout you want. Government can provide things to groups of people or everyone, but that doesn't make their country socialist. If it did, because you also hear this critique, people will say, well, if you support public parks and public schools and public airports or public museums, that's socialist too. But that doesn't make sense, because think about the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. I mean, clearly the Soviet Union was a socialist country. The United States was not in comparison. Yet both of these countries had public roads, had public schools, had public hospitals, but only one of them had government nationalizing almost all industries and centrally planning the economy, which is the essence of what socialism is. So when you get to the point where government, the means of production are primarily found within government or central planners, and then everyone kind of puts their wages into a kind of a communal pot that are redistributed to everyone else, that's when you're getting to true socialism. But you must be careful, because like the frog in the boiling pot, you get to socialism incrementally through these different kinds of policies. So that was a lot there. Is that a helpful answer to your question?
That's very helpful. I appreciate it.
Okay, great. And Alan, stay on the line and we will get you a copy of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist, which we'll also get to anyone else who calls in the first hour of the show today, if you make it in the first hour and you have a question. So thank you so much, Alan. Moving on to our next caller, we have Bobby from Los Angeles, California, watching us on YouTube Live. It's that gentleman, Mr. Rockwell, who once said, I feel like somebody's watching me and I have no privacy. Because it's Bobby in Los Angeles, California on YouTube Live, which that's okay. I don't expect privacy on the show right now. Welcome. What is your question for us?
Hi, Kathleen, Catherine and Trent. First of all, I just wanted to say, Trent, I called you up before, and in that call, I accidentally called the Pope a dictator. And I'm really sorry about that. I hope you will forgive me, and he will as well.
That's okay. It's part of his job. He has to. He's the Pope.
So I'm also currently reading your book, Hard Things, and I really like it.
Thanks.
Directly to the point of the call, I want to take a slightly different tack.
Sure.
And talk about Jesus and Luke in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And basically why he is critical of wealth sometimes. Because I think that sure. You might agree that there are, he's critical of people who are too wealthy in that book a little bit. Is that a safe?
He's very critical of the wealthy. Yes. Yes.
And so I was kind of speculating as to why that is, and I thought it was because people who have too much wealth, at least in that time, that kind of thing, were showing a lack of regard for the things of God and being too focused on the things of the world. And the things of God, including, of course, voluntarily helping other people, etc., which is not socialism. But so then the problem, I would say, in our modern society might be that we emphasize personal improvement so much in terms of elevating your status financially that I wonder if it's responsible for too much focus on materialism, ironically, a kind of Marx-type materialism instead of focusing on the things of God and things that are ultimately more important like that.
Okay, so your question is related to what was the rationale behind Jesus's critique of the wealthy in his time, and do we have to be concerned about materialism and a love of goods kind of choking our love for God? Is that a good summary of your question or concern?
Yeah, and I think there's a tendency that capitalism maybe encourages that, both of those things.
Sure. I'd love for both of us. I'll take a stab at that, and then I'm sure Catherine definitely has thoughts. First, what I would say is what the Bible teaches, the Bible does not teach, and neither did Jesus teach, that having wealth was intrinsically evil. Though the Bible does teach it's a great source of temptation for people. 1 Timothy 6:10 is often misquoted in Paul's writings as saying that money is the root of all evil. Actually, what Paul said in 1 Timothy 6:10 is that the love of money is the root of all evil. So why did Jesus condemn the wealthy? And he said that it'd be easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into heaven. Now, this was not a blanket condemnation of anyone who had wealth, because there were people who found favor in God's eyes who were wealthy throughout Scripture. You think of Job, Abraham, even in Jesus's time, the reason Jesus was buried in a tomb was because one of his followers was very wealthy. That was Joseph of Arimathea, a member of the Sanhedrin. When Jesus met with Zacchaeus, the tax collector, Zacchaeus promised, when he had a conversion experience upon meeting Jesus, he promised to repay everyone what he had defrauded them and to give away half of his wealth. And now, if you're a very wealthy person, you could still be really wealthy even if you give away half your wealth. If Bill Gates gives away half his net worth, he's still super rich. So Jesus didn't say that Zacchaeus had to give everything away. He said instead, because of Zacchaeus' generosity, salvation has now come to this house. Jesus' concern was that in his time, given the economies of ancient Rome, was that it was nearly everyone. It was almost impossible to become wealthy without exploiting others. There was a famous Mediterranean proverb in the time of Jesus that said, every rich man is a thief or the son of a thief. That in Jesus' time, you could not just grow wealth through industry and through commerce like we can today. Usually it was through exploitive taxation. It was through forcefully taking goods from others through conquest. And so that was like Zacchaeus. He got wealthy because he was an exploitive tax collector. So in Jesus's time, to become wealthy, you had to almost usually be immoral. Not always, but it was very, very common. Whereas today, it is possible for people, it happens all the time. People become wealthy, and this is what Pope Leo XIII talks about in his encyclicals, about thrift, frugality, and savings over time, that because people have, in 30 years, through just thrift and frugality and compound interest, a person can become wealthier now than any ancient person ever had in the time of Christ, or almost any ancient person. So Jesus there is condemning the common behaviors and traits of his time, but not wealth in and of itself, though he does admit, and Paul would say the same, it's a source of great temptation. Catherine, would you like to add any more to that? Or
I'm really glad, Bobby, I'm really glad you raised the question, because it's something that if I think anybody that is blessed to participate in a functioning and healthy economy like ours, as I am, I mean, if this isn't something you struggle with on a, you know, daily, weekly, yearly basis, like how much is enough and am I giving enough away? Am I doing enough? Then there probably is something wrong. You know, so I think Jesus is quite clear. And I think that the Christian tradition has been really clear that, you know, anything above sustenance means we have now an obligation to think about how much we can help our brothers. And our brothers in need, as Jesus was so clear, may not be always the people that are first immediately obvious to us. So that, I just want to point that out. But as to the point of whether or not capitalism providing all of this wealth does more harm than good, I'd want to be a little bit worried about that, sort of for the following reason. One of the things that is interesting about what capitalism tends to do, and I would not say always, but I would say tends to do in the presence of, you know, sound policy and regulation, is that it does tend to create this upward swing in wealth and mobility for people. And what we expect to see is both growth at the top, right? So the rich get richer, but we also expect to see the poor get richer too. And we don't know very much how to sort of cap off the rich getting richer without also capping off the poor getting richer. We want the poor to get richer. We want the working class to kind of be able to enter. A phrase that I really like that Pope Francis used was the economy of inclusion, right? So what we kind of want to have is more and more people brought into that.
Okay, well, Bobby, I hope you'll stay with us. We'll tie a bow on this when we come back. And be sure to give our call screener your information, and we will send you a copy of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? Stay on the line. Give our call screener your info. We'll send you the book. Linda, Roger, Carolyn, stay on the line. We're going to get through these callers as much as we can. Coming right back to you.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Are you bombarded by robocalls?
We want to hear from you on tomorrow's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie at noon Eastern.
Now let's get back to more of Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome back to the second half of the first hour here at Catholic Answers Live. This is Trent Horn, staff apologist at Catholic Answers, filling in for Mr. Cy Kellett, who's circling above us as we speak, probably trying to find a runway to land. And we hope to bring him here back in the studio soon to enjoy his warm, fuzzy, effervescent presence. But until then, you have me as a host and half a guest. One guest. We have two guests today, because it's helpful. They're both authors of the book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? The answer is no. Here's Why, authored by myself and Catherine Pakalik, Associate Professor of Economics at the Catholic University of America. Let's jump right back in to those calls. Linda, listening to us at Covenant Radio in St. Louis, Missouri, what question do you have for Catherine and myself about socialism or economics?
I'm wondering why, but you didn't begin with what my understanding is the biggest reason the Church is against socialism, especially in its more extreme forms, is the agenda of the socialists is utopia, but they have to get rid of God and the family, the basis of the Judeo-Christian ethic I got that idea when I saw this wonderful documentary of Wolf in Sheep's Clothing some years ago in the WCN, and I've been reading, and why didn't you begin with that, or do I not understand it correctly?
No, you absolutely do understand it. This is one of the critiques, and I'll let Catherine speak to this, but I'll just quickly say, in Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Arcanum on Christian Marriage, he criticizes those among socialists who think that the inherent character of marriage can be perverted with impunity, and who, disregarding the sanctity of religion and of the sacrament, that they want to essentially make the state become a family to replace the nuclear family, the biological family. In early socialist writings, you see this. Friedrich Engels, who's a collaborator of Karl Marx, wrote about this in The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State. Leon Trotsky, who was a Soviet Union socialist, said the revolution, the socialist revolution, made a heroic effort to destroy the so-called family hearth and replace it with a complete absorption of the housekeeping functions of the family by institutions of the socialist society. And this is something we still find today, especially among Marxist socialists. There is a book by Sophie Ann Lewis that just came out last year called Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family. And it's the idea that for the goal of socialism is that families don't exist. Marx, Engels said that family was a way for capitalists and the bourgeoisie to concentrate wealth and pass it on to their children. And they want to just no more families. We're all one human family and we have equal responsibilities to one another as opposed to our biological ties. But that flies in the face of what has been revealed to us in scripture and in the teaching of the church, which I'm sure Catherine can speak to very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think I could add very much. I mean, I think, Trent, you just really covered that so well. But yeah, Pope Leo, right away, you know, by the time he gets to about paragraph 8, you know, right at the beginning of Rerum Novarum, he says, you know, besides the fact that socialism subverts the God-given rights that he describes, he says, but the big thing is that a man should be responsible for his family. So that's right that the children depend upon the father and not on the state. So he worries directly and right up front, right at the beginning, that the problem here is that we're going to sort of rip apart the structure of the family. So yes, I mean, I just think you're really onto something really important here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, Linda, thank you so much for calling in, and make sure you stay on the line so we can get you your complimentary copy of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? Yeah. The answer is no. Here's why. If you would like a copy of the book and you cannot get through on the phone lines today, be sure to go to shop.catholic.com to get your copy of the book. I know they were out of stock recently on online book retailers, and we're filling the orders as fast as we can, but they're moving. And because a lot of people are concerned about this, are confused, thinking, well, can I be a socialist? They may have come across articles in the Catholic Herald or in the New York Times by Christians and Catholics who claim you not only can be a socialist, but you should be one based on scripture and church teaching. And so Catherine and I rebut that fully in our book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist?, along with correcting misconceptions that people have about capitalism. So be sure to get that. Go to shop.catholic.com to get your copy of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? Let's go to our next caller, Roger, in San Antonio, Texas, listening to us on Guadalupe Radio. Roger, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hey, first, Trent, I want to say you're my favorite apologist. I got 5 of your books, listen to the Council of Trent. Keep doing what you're doing, brother.
Well, thank you very much. You're too kind.
Yes. My question is, what's the similarities and differences, and which came first between Marxism, socialism, and communism, and how far is socialism from communism?
Sure, and I'm sure Catherine and I both have thoughts on this. In writing our book, when we have pursued and reviewed socialist literature, it can become very difficult to pin people down exactly what they mean on these terms. We even quote a textbook, The Essentials of Sociology, which says that the terms socialism and communism are often used interchangeably amongst the same authors even. So the bottom line is this, that the first terms to emerge would be, so prior to Marxism, the idea of socialism emerged before the writings of Karl Marx. Its earliest forms, you had utopian idealists in France and others. It was really the product of the French Revolution, which was at the end of the 18th century, a belief in if the state had enough power and allocated the resources the right way, the state could ensure a kind of utopia on Earth and rid the world of poverty and things like this. In fact, there is a famous book called Voyage to Icaria, and the author of that talks about a fictional land called Icaria, where a state, and the motto is something like, a state with enough resources can do anything for its citizens, which is basically what all socialists have been saying forever and continue to get wrong, as we show in the historical outline of our book. So socialism, the term begins around like the year 1820 or so. You see the term socialist arising. Then several years later, you see it co-opted by Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, other early socialists who espouse, they combine this view of socialism, this economic view, with Hegelian philosophy. So that's the work of the philosopher Hegel. This idea, and Hegel believed, this gets pretty heady pretty quick, about the idea that there are a thesis and antithesis in the philosophy of history, competing ideas, and when they essentially clash with each other, we get a synthesis of ideas. And so there's this idea of kind of a clash or conflict theory throughout history that Marx adopts from Hegel. And that takes the view that, well, the clash has always been between the owners, the bourgeoisie, and the workers, the exploited workers of the proletariat. So it's slave owners, slaves, lords and serfs. And finally, now it's factory owners and workers. And it's time for the workers to rise up. The famous thing in the Communist Manifesto, they said that workers of the world rise up. The only thing you have to lose is your chains, basically. And so this is published as the Communist Manifesto. And so the terms socialism and communism are usually used, sometimes interchangeably, but also to refer to stages of development. The idea is that on the way to pure communism, where there's no classes, no rich, no poor, no workers, or sorry, no employers, no workers, we're all equal amongst each other, we have to have the state mandate this equality and centrally plan everything first. So usually socialism is kind of a waypoint to communism, especially for Marxists. And there are socialists today who say, well, I'm not a Marxist, but I'm this or that. The bottom line we talk about in the book is that socialism at its core is about, and this is what other economists will say, it is about the restriction or the supplantation of the market in favor of a central authority planning the economy, which involves planning prices. So if you think of the price of a good or a wage, which is essentially the price of labor, instead of the market deciding that and through private actors, you have a government or a central authority planning it and dictating it so, and dictating how much is produced, how much is distributed amongst people. And so they all are really connected. People will try to water them down over the years, make more moderate socialism. But that's what it is at its core. And all the concepts are really intricately linked together. Catherine, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I think that's a brave summary of a very complicated set of three issues. But I don't think among those three, communism, socialism, Marxism, it's not as if you could single one out and say, well, here's the good version, right? I mean, I think that's part of the problem, is that a lot of times socialists show up and they say, well, we're not like those evil communists that are violent or radical Marxists. We're the nice socialists. There's not sort of a better version, at least not from the perspective of Catholic thought, that they are kind of competing for kind of, you know, bad actors. They're all kind of competing. And the other thing I would add is that to Trent's point about how they're all, generally speaking, in various flavors, in favor of a kind of centrally planned social order, beyond just prices and centrally planned economics, we typically have in these various versions a commitment to something like the confiscation of private property,
right?
Since you can't replace the market mechanisms for prices unless you also supplant private property on some level, and then usually some greater or lesser commitment to the nationalization of industries, right? So some degree to which the government or the state takes over or runs or delegates the running of enterprise and business.
And that's what's happened. We should also remember that some people say, well, that's just the Soviet Union 100 years ago. No, this is still prevalent in the world today. We see this, the prime examples of this, of socialism in action, to judge for ourselves, would be countries like Venezuela and Cuba. In Venezuela, the government engaged in something called expropriation of businesses. Mm-hmm. So they would take private businesses and say, guess what? The government owns this business now. Fire the workers, put in their own workers and bosses, and tell them, you have to produce X amount of goods and sell them at this price. And then the companies, at first they'd say, well, we can't produce this high amount at such a low price, we'll go bankrupt. And then Chavez would send in troops to enforce it. And then finally he would just take over the companies and make them do it. Mm-hmm. But the problem was, without a profit mechanism, these domestic, including like domestic food suppliers, would always have shortages because there wasn't an incentive to produce what needed to be created. And so then the grocery stores, which were subsidized by the government, the shelves ran bare. In Venezuela, mm-hmm. people lost on average something like 20 pounds, the Venezuelan diet and malnourishment. And then also to restrict this, we see this in Cuba, which we document in the book, that even today in Cuba, most transactions are conducted on the black market. To have a socialist economy where government plans everything and says, you have this much, you make this, you can't have private actors selling things. So in Cuba, you can go to jail for 15 or 20 years for illegally selling eggs and meat and chickens, which normally here in the U.S. you would go away for selling drugs or weapons for that kind of amount. So it's mm-hmm. something that's still with us today, and why we are so leery of this, and why we wrote this book to warn people about the hazards of socialism the popes have been warning us about for 150 years. So I'm grateful for the call. Definitely make sure you're on the line. You give your number so we can get your info to our call screener, Roger. And if you want your copy, go to shop.catholic.com, get Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? We are happy to get that for you. And by the way, if you go to shop.catholic.com, you have a lot of other resources that you can get there, because we have our store-wide spring sale. All of our books, CDs, DVDs, MP3s, ebooks, and more are on sale for 10 to 25% off. A great time to stock up on those resources at shop.catholic.com.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Our mission is to transform the world one woman at a time through a spiritual program of formation that helps them to see who they are as daughters of the Most High God and to enjoy the gift that God has given to them by virtue of their femininity.
Women of Grace with Jeanette Bankovic Williams. Tomorrow morning, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to our first hour of Catholic Answers Live. I'm filling in for PsyCal today. I'm Trent Horn, Catholic apologist and speaker, and co-author of the new book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? The answer is no. Here's why. My co-author, Catherine Pakolik, Associate Professor of Economics at the Catholic University of America, is here with us as well to answer your questions on socialism, capitalism, church teaching, on economics, and so much more. Would you like to head back to the phones?
Absolutely.
Let's do it. We're having too much fun today on a Monday, of all things. Too much fun on a Monday. We're going to Carolyn in Deadwood, South Dakota on Real Presence Radio. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's your question?
I actually have two questions. So I'm like in my late 30s. So when I hear the term like social justice, I more equate that with like socialist candidates that run for president or kind of socialist themes. Mm-hmm. But then I've been looking lately at people like Dorothy Day, and she uses the term too.
Yes.
And so my first question was, when Dorothy Day talks about social justice, is that what like some of the people in, say, today's politics, are they using the term in the same way, or is our modern term of social justice different than it would have been for like Dorothy Day? And then my second question is I recently got a bunch of old books from my grandpa who he had them like in the 1940s. They're all, you know, copyright 1940s. And a bunch of them talk about like some of the titles or stuff like the Catholic and the cooperative way. And they're like talking about like the cooperative way. Mm-hmm. Is that like a synonym for communism that would have been used maybe back in the 40s? Because, I mean, they're all written by like priests and all this other stuff.
Sure.
But I'm just kind of, it just kind of turns me off to just see the title. It's like, oh, the cooperative way. I'm not sure that that's truly something.
Yeah. What you have to do is understand something called semantic shift, that words, especially words like social justice, they change their meaning. People will apply different meanings to them in different contexts. So you always have to go beyond the word itself to look at the meaning of the terms and the proposal behind the terms. So I'm not familiar with the cooperative way that you're discussing, but it sounds similar. If it's from the 1940s, it may have been part of the Catholic Workers Movement, which is what Dorothy Day belonged to. And it could also be a part of the cooperative movement in businesses. So there are businesses that share profits with employees and share decision-making capacities with employees, and they do that voluntarily. The largest and oldest company that does that in the world is called the Mondragon Corporation, located in the Basque region in Spain. And so what they do, now it's a very large company, has thousands of workers, and a large percentage of them, not all of them, but a large percentage of them share in the company's profits. They're involved in decision making. And you see these similar cooperatives on very small businesses with like maybe 6 to 8 people. There's no boss. Everyone kind of splits things evenly. That's not the same with Mondragon, but it's the largest set of this. And it was started by a Catholic priest, actually. And there's nothing wrong with that. Catholic social teaching would actually consider that something very viable for companies that want to voluntarily set up a business where there's equal profit, there's profit sharing and worker owners. So you're a worker, but also a part owner of the company. The church perfectly allows people to engage in those kinds of enterprises. What the church would be against, based on the principle of subsidiarity, would be government imposing certain structures upon private businesses that end up ultimately to the detriment of to the owners and workers of those businesses, such as requiring these kinds of cooperatives for every single kind of business. Not every business does cooperatives because they can be inefficient. I mean, imagine, you know, some people may think, oh, it's great, I don't have a boss. Well, you do. If it's a small company, every employee is your boss. I've read articles about companies where they can't make a decision about which condiments to replace at the burger stand until everybody agrees at a meeting of 10 people. And so nothing ever changes because it's hard to get 10 people to ever agree on anything. So that might be what the cooperatives are referring to, but they're something that are licit. They just should be mandated across the board. Second, when it comes to Dorothy Day, so she founded the Catholic Workers Movement. And what she believed about social justice was about people being treated with dignity and equality. And especially the Catholic workers believed in being poor with the poor. They had these houses of hospitality to help those to be able to get on their feet and to support themselves. Day herself is very skeptical of government assistance. She even said in 1944 that Social Security was a great defeat for Christianity. She would quote St. Hilary of Poitiers, who said, "The less we ask of Caesar, the less we'll have to render to Caesar." Rather, the modern democratic socialism came from her disciple, Michael Harrington, who left the Catholic Workers when he said Catholic Workers was as far left as you could go, and I wanted to go further. And he became an atheist, and he started the Democratic Socialists, which went further and took a much broader, different view of social justice than Dorothy Day did. So as a spiel, Catherine, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, one tiny thing to add, Carolyn, is a really good question about social justice. I think it's a great example of the kind of thing that happens, phenomenon that happens over and over, which is that the church, we think of the treasury of the church, all these riches that the church has, and a lot of times sort of the vulnerability of the church is that some of these treasures get kind of, you know, borrowed from the church. And by and large, you know, this was true even in Jesus's day with his apostles. You know, they'd be like, well, hey, there's people out preaching in your name. And Jesus says, well, if they're not against us, you know, it's okay. But there's something like that going on with social justice, right? It's part of the deposit of the the faith of the church. You can find a nice definition of social justice in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, point 1928. This is something that we own and we love to think about and talk about. Justice is something we have a long tradition on. And so there's nothing wrong with social justice, but to Trent's point, it's been kind of co-opted and used. And now in this particular case, it is in some ways being used against us and can be used against us. But we definitely don't want to give up the term completely and say, well, no, actually, social justice always means what our enemies say that it means, right?
Right.
It's a lovely concept, and it's something that we have a lot to say about. And so it does mean a lot to me, and I know to Trent, too, we're sort of both teachers at heart, to kind of, insist, put my foot down and say, no, like, this isn't a term that belongs to the left. It's a term that belongs to the church. And like everything awesome that the church has, people want to come along and borrow it because it's pretty great.
Right. Carolyn, is that a helpful reply for you?
Well, yes, it was, just because we've been doing so much around here, like in our diocese, they've been, in the bulletin, you'll see like, oh, we're going to have a social justice committee. And so I always kind of get leery because, like, yeah. You said, the only term of social justice that I was familiar with was the one, mm-hmm. like you said, that like the far, far left uses. And so knowing, that Pope Pius XI said, you can't be socialist and a Catholic.
Yeah, but that's socialism, not social justice.
Yeah, and it's right in our catechism, in the current catechism of the Catholic Church. And even Pope Pius XI actually said that actually the path for civil society was that we'd be anchored between the pillars of social justice and social charity, actually. So the popes are not against social justice so long as we are talking about social justice and not about socialism.
So the key to make the distinction, Carolyn, is this: with social justice and socialism, it's right to treat equals equally and unequals unequally. It's wrong to treat unequals as if they were equal. And it's wrong to treat equals unequally. So see, equals should be treated equally, but unequals are treated unequally. So me and LeBron James, have unequal skills when it comes to basketball. It would be a crime to give me millions of dollars to play basketball because I am terrible at it. But both LeBron James and I should, if we, are dying and need help, we should both have a right to a trial. We should both have access to proper basic medical care. We should be treated equally in virtue of our humanity, which we have as equals. But, he's way better at basketball, so he should get paid a lot more than me because he's so much better at it. The problem with socialism is what it does is it takes people who are very unequal in talents, skills, and abilities and says, no, you're all actually really equal. We're going to treat you equally as such. And social justice gets wrong when it tries to get rid of those natural inequalities that exist, something Pope Leo XIII mentioned. But social justice gets it right when it recognizes our equal dignity as human beings who deserve to be treated with dignity and respect in the basic elements of our rights and dignity how we ought to be treated. So we'll send you the book, Carolyn, and I hope it fills in some of the gaps there for you. And I'm glad you called. We probably have time for one more call. We have Steve in Kentucky listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Steve, what is your question?
Hey, Trent, it's Steve.
Howdy.
The main reason I called was, one reason was because I said, you're going to give me a book. And I was like, wow, I hope that doesn't make me a socialist because I want it for free. No.
It makes you, you worked. You stayed on the line. You've earned the book for your 50 minutes.
It was work.
You worked. You got your book. There you go. So what's your question?
No, I love you guys, man. You guys are awesome. Hey, I've had people come to me and say, well, hey, Canada works on it. I don't even know if Canada's socialist or not, but they say, well, Canada is a socialist nation and they're doing okay. Is that true? Or I'm sure they're not full socialists of what we're like Cuba and Venezuela.
No, and I would recommend a resource to compare countries. Remember, we talk about socialism as central planning of economies, government planning, restricting the market, removing the market. Based elements for private firms and actors to buy and sell goods. If you go to the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org/index, the Heritage Foundation has an index of economic freedom where they rank countries based on how economically free they are, which are more capitalist, or how economically unfree they are, which makes them socialist. The most economically unfree country in the world is Venezuela, North Korea, Cuba. Canada on the list, I'm looking at it right now, is number 8 8 out of like 200. So Canada
is above the United States.
It is. So it has a health system different than ours, but actually has a very robust free market economy. Canada is not a socialist system. You can debate things like specific policy proposals and social welfare spending, but what you can't debate as a Catholic is socialism and government centrally planning things. Enjoy our book. Thank you guys for listening. And if you want a copy of the book, go to Can a Catholic Be a Socialist at shop.catholic.com. Catherine, thanks for coming by.
Oh, thanks. It was great.
And I hope you'll stick around for Dr. Gregory and Jacob Popcheck coming up next, how to fast from falsehoods here on Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back.